you know, I think global Shakespeare has so many extraordinary stories to tell, and I think they're going to become more and more to the front of how we think about Shakespeare, and I think that's a fantastic thing.
That was Edward Wilson Lee talking about Shakespeare's global impact.
Both the English cricket authorities, certainly the captain and the management, wanted to make money out of this tour, as did James Logan. But because this second tour in 1891 did not make the money they had expected, James Logan had the English cricket team arrested as they boarded their ship back to England.
And that was Dean Allen discussing how cricket came to South Africa in the 19th century. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Hello and welcome to our third podcast of April 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. It probably hasn't escaped many of you that in just a couple of days, on the 23rd of April, it will be 400 years since the death of William Shakespeare. A whole raft of TV and radio programmes, events and activities are planned to mark this anniversary, and a slew of new books have been published. Among them is Shakespeare in Swahili Land, Adventures with the Ever-Living Poet, by Edward Wilson Lee, which focuses on Shakespeare's extraordinary global reach. Our book's editor, Matt Elton, caught up with Edward recently and began by asking him what inspired him to write this book.
It started out as quite a small research project on a character called Edward Steer, who was the third missionary bishop to Central Africa, who is based in Zanzibar. And he translated a small pamphlet of Shakespearean stories into Swahili and printed it in Zanzibar in the 1860s as one of the first printed texts in Swahili. And this was an absolutely kind of thrilling discovery for me because it linked two things that are most dear to me, which is East Africa, the region in which I grew up, and Shakespeare, whose works I teach for a living. And so it started out as a very kind of small project, but as I dug a little deeper, its tentacles spread out, and there were so many extraordinary stories about people reading and translating and performing Shakespeare in East Africa, that it clearly was a much bigger project. And I think even more than that, what's exciting when you're doing historical research is when you've found not just one kind of odd incident or two, but enough of them that they start to give a sense of a compulsion for lots of different people to do something unexplained and strange. And that's when you know that you're really onto a kind of fascinating and undiscovered story. So that was how this project started.
Shakespeare's obviously going to be huge news for the next 12 months or so, but this feels like a story that's not really been explored as much. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, obviously historically this had to do with Shakespeare being a kind of totem of Britishness, and therefore, reading Shakespeare in the rest of the world tended to be kind of looked down upon in some ways. But I think, even now, we give into that human compulsion to search for origins. We think if we know a little bit more about who Shakespeare was and the context in which he wrote, that we'll be able to unlock the secret of his plays. But I really think that it's a slightly strange way to look at things, because it's sort of like looking at the plans that a general drew up for a battle instead of following what actually happened afterwards. And what happened after Shakespeare wrote his plays is that they became this global phenomenon and were read in and used and explored in ways he could never have anticipated. And what's important about Shakespeare is that he is capable of generating interest and providing significance and being found beautiful in times and in places that really go beyond his immediate historical context. So, I think global Shakespeare has so many extraordinary stories to tell, and I think they're going to become more and more to the front of how we think about Shakespeare, and I think that's a fantastic thing.
Mm. You travelled to a fair number of countries in the course of researching this book. Where did you head to, and what sort of stories did you find out, I guess?
Yeah, so I was largely based in Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, although there were also sort of trips to South Sudan and to Ethiopia to pursue other bits of this story. And the story really begins with the Victorian cartographic expeditions, people like Burton and Stanley, and early travellers to the region who seem to have this, as I've said, compulsion to take Shakespeare with them as their only reading, and to protest that this is the only reading that they're taking with him, and to leave kind of extraordinary diary entries about reading Shakespeare in the dark continent and ravaged by malarial fevers and things like that. So that's where the project sort of starts, and as Shakespeare being taken to this region as a totem of Britishness. But I think where it starts to get really interesting is when it's taken up by taken up and transformed by those reading it in East Africa, who kind of make it their own, and later use it against the colonizers to show them, I suppose, in some ways, how far they were falling short of their own cultural values.
That's so interesting. How did they do that?
There's a lovely story from the 1950s about a chap called Eliud Mathew, who was on the governance council, which provided some kind of platform for Kenyans to speak to the British colonial government. And there's a wonderful instance, for instance, where he tells them the story of a particular tax that they're going to impose upon the Gikuyu, as if it were the story of the Merchant of Venice, and showing them to be the kind of Shylock figure who is intentionally setting up a contract that they know the other person will fail to live up to, so that they can persecute that person. And it's this wonderful kind of holding up of a cultural mirror to the colonial regime, and saying, you pretend to have these great cultural values, but actually you are behaving just as the villains in your own stories do. So I think there are wonderful episodes like that, but so it starts as a way of taking something from the colonial oppressor and turning it against them, but it increasingly becomes something that that they make their own. And so the Ethiopian and Swahili translations are from the 60s and 70s are really discover new things about Shakespeare, which we're coming closer, in the last 20 or 30 years to thinking of Shakespeare in those ways in European and American academia. But the funny thing is that actually many of these readings were there beforehand in strange and unexpected places.
Mm. Are there particular plays that have particular resonances in certain countries or areas?
Yeah, so The Merchant of Venice and Julius Caesar were extraordinarily popular throughout this story and throughout these regions. I think that's in part because of this, the number of different ways that they can be read as, a moral fable about the impact that predatory economic practices have upon a society, about the exclusion of people on the basis of race or misunderstood cultural values, but also in Julius Caesar about, thinking about revolution and really more importantly than that, what comes after it, the kinds of betrayals and the temptation towards retribution, really the practice of living after you have overthrown a tyrant. We think in some ways about Julius Caesar as a play about the death of Julius Caesar, but most of the interesting stuff in the play happens after that. It's about how the aftermath tears apart the people who overthrew the oppressor, and then have to find a way to make that you know, that vision of a life after its stick. So those were kind of central place. There are other ones, you know, that interestingly don't feature. So you might expect Othello as Shakespeare's major treatment of a black character to feature in the history of Shakespeare in East Africa, but it's really not very present at all. And I suppose that's because when you think about it, Othello is the story of a single black man in a white society, whereas that's very different from the experience of people living in a situation where the colonial oppressor is in the minority.
Mm. There's some huge characters in this book. Are there any that particularly stand out for you, either as heroes or as being overlooked, I suppose, elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think the great hero of the story for me is someone who perhaps couldn't be called overlooked. You know, Julius Nyerere was the first president of an independent Tanzania. But the centrality of Shakespeare to his story is, I think, something that not very many people know about and about which not much was known before I started looking into it here. And so what's so utterly extraordinary to me is that not only was he the first person to translate full Shakespeare plays, The Merchant of Venice and Julius Caesar, into Swahili, someone leading a newly independent country and hammering out a constitution and trying to develop this notion of African socialism, which was his idea of what a post-independence Africa would be like. But what's utterly extraordinary was that he was doing these things at the same time, and they seemed to be kind of linked projects for him in a way. He was a man of extraordinary moral character and rhetorical skill, but these plays, I think, helped him to think through the problems that he was facing after independence. So the popular call for retribution against the former colonists, the danger of corruption and newly founded states, the way to find a balance between the need for kind of economic stability and growth and the cultural values of the country. So he was thinking about these things in hammering out this constitution and in translating Shakespeare, and in a way that makes him an extraordinary reader of Shakespeare. You know, we have very few stories in which the people reading and translating and writing about a character like Brutus have essentially lived through being Brutus. So it's an extraordinary part of the story. There are lots of other people who I think equally deserve to be known better or known in a different light. So the extraordinary Shakespearean stories of someone like Henry Morton Stanley, the plays of the great Indian translator of Shakespeare, Aga Hasha Kashmiri, and who's known as the kind of Indian Shakespeare, the Ethiopian poet laureate Tsegaye Gebremedin, who used Shakespeare as a form of political resistance to Haile Selassie. You know, the list goes on, but there are lots of just fantastic figures in this story.
What was the thing that surprised you the most in the course of your research?
In terms of kind of individual incidents, I suppose actually the greatest shock came in finding out that Che Guevara had spent a period of months locked away with his wife in a room above the Cuban embassy in Dar es Salaam, reading Shakespeare as he recovered from leading a failed revolution in the Congo. And that was one of those moments at which, you know, it got to a point in the research where I kind of had a bet with myself that I could find anyone, you know, anyone who'd spent any time in East Africa was going to have a period which they spent reading Shakespeare. So it started, you know, it's one of those points where it started out seeming like this bizarre project, which, you know, no one could believe I was undertaking. Least of all people, a lot of people in East Africa. But it increasingly became apparent that, you know, so many people were driven to think about this, the idea of universal culture, when traveling in a place that was foreign to them, that it was really, a kind of compulsion, and that it was going to be an exciting story to tell.
Mm. If you could somehow travel back in time and ask someone involved in this whole great story a question, or perhaps witness a scene, what would you choose?
Oh, in terms of a scene, I'd love to have been there during this extraordinary culture of Shakespeare performance among Indian settler communities in Mombasa in the early part of 20th century. It's something that I've been able to piece together fragments about. But there was a time at which Mombasa was as much of a centre of Shakespeare performance as London's West End. And Shakespeare plays being played in Indian languages in these extraordinary kind of irreverent and innovative ways to Indian settlers in Mombasa. I'd love to have been there for that. So I think in terms of a scene that I'd love to have witnessed, that would probably come pretty close to top of the list. In terms of questions I'd love to ask people, I'd love to ask Edward Stear, the character with whom this project began, why he chose the four Shakespeare plays he did to translate into Shakespeare's into stories for East African school children. So this was The Taming of the Shrew, The Merchant of Venice, King Lear, and Timon of Athens. And it's one of those puzzles about how to connect four seemingly disparate things that I think I've had a pretty good stab at answering in the book, but it's always going to gnaw at me that I won't be sure whether or not that's the right answer.
You also, I think, in the book talk about performances of Shakespeare's plays. Are there any particularly unusual such performances that stand out, I guess?
So again, there's an extraordinary story among these Indian Shakespeare performances in Mombasa in the early part of the century, where an Indian playwright called Mahadi Hassan has adapted Twelfth Night. And instead of the shipwreck which opens Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, this is transformed into a train wreck, which is particularly touching, I think, in this circumstance, because these Indian settlers were bought over by the British specifically to build the railway from Mombasa to the Great Lakes. An episode which led to a lot of them being killed. And so it's profoundly touching that they've found a way to connect this play written for, late Elizabethan Londoners to their lives in Mombasa. So I think that's a kind of transformation that stands out.
That's amazing. Thank you. In this anniversary year, how would you like this book to change how people view Shakespeare, his works, and I guess this whole story?
Yeah, so I think anniversaries are a good time. Anniversaries always struck me as kind of like rhymes in poetry. It puts two things that are, different next to each other, two words or two years, and asks us to think about how they're similar and how they're different. And I think, I'd like to focus on the now as much as the past in this anniversary year. I think there are so many extraordinary stories from global Shakespeare about Shakespeare having been transformed in other times and other places, and himself helping to transform the people who are reading and performing and translating and writing about him. So I'd like to hear more of those stories, alongside the incessant need to write new Shakespeare biographies. I think also, though, as much of it being a book about Shakespeare, this is a book about East Africa, and I'd love to encourage more people to take an interest in the cultural riches of this region. I think this is a prime tourist destination, largely for the natural beauty, but very few people take much interest in the extraordinary writers and thinkers that the region has produced or its rich history. So I'd love to encourage more people to think about that as well.
On that note, do you think this book has any lessons for us in the 21st century?
I think one of its lessons is to be cautious about assuming that historical evils saw themselves as evils. I think a lot of these people who we'd now see as being rather patronizing or culturally paternalistic towards the people with whom they were dealing, thought they were, you know, very much doing the right thing. I think it's very easy to look back at history and assume that, you know, the evil people were malicious and the good people were benevolent. But I think actually, you know, a lot of the people who ended up doing things that we think rather less well of nowadays were benevolent. They wanted good things, and they simply had thought through them in ways that we don't think through them. So that might be a caution in some ways to think about our own acts of supposed benevolence and how they might be judged by people looking back from the future.
That was Edward Wilson Lee. Shakespeare in Swahili Land, Adventures with the Ever-Living Poet, is out now in the UK, published by William Collins. In the US, it's due to be published in September by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. And you can read more about Shakespeare in the April edition of BBC History magazine, which is just about to go off sale. You can still pick up a copy today in all good newsagents in the UK, and it will be available after that in our many digital formats and as a back issue. Meanwhile, we're also launching a new collector's edition all about Shakespeare and his times. You can find out more about this and order your copy at buysubscriptions.com/Shakespeare. That's buysubscriptions.com/Shakespeare. Now, we know that it does take a little longer for the magazine to make it outside the UK, so in many countries it will still be our March edition that's in the shops. And this month we're offering some special bonus content for some of our overseas readers. If you pick up a copy of the magazine in Barnes & Noble in the US, you'll have a chance to read an extra article on the 10 days that forged the United States. Meanwhile, if you buy your magazine at a store in Australia, you'll get an additional piece on the great myths of convict transportation. So if that sounds of interest to you, then make sure to seek out our March edition now. Now it's time for the latest history news with our website assistant, Ellie Cawthorne.
Benedict Cumberbatch, Judi Dench and Helen Mirren are among a list of actors and performers due to mark the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare on Saturday. In a live broadcast from the Royal Shakespeare Company on BBC Two, hosted by David Tennant and Catherine Tait, Shakespeare Live will celebrate the playwright's legacy and his enduring influence on performance art forms. Highlights include bard-inspired jazz and hip-hop, plus performances from the English National Opera and the Birmingham Royal Ballet. Shakespeare Live from the RSC airs on BBC Two on Saturday the 23rd of April at 8:30pm. In other news, a Roman villa has been unearthed by a homeowner laying electric cables in his garden in Wiltshire. Thought to be one of the largest of its kind in the country, the villa was discovered by rug designer Luke Irwin while he was working on his farmhouse so that his children could play table tennis in an old barn. Historic England said the discovery of the well-preserved villa was, quote, unparalleled in recent years. Finds, including high-status pottery, coins, brooches, and hundreds of oysters, which were carried live from the coast, suggest that the villa was owned by a wealthy family. The villa is believed to have been built sometime between AD 175 and AD 220. Speaking to BBC News, Dr. David Roberts of Historic England said, "It's clearly not your run-of-the-mill domestic settlement." Meanwhile, a grisly account of how three victims of the Titanic were found in an abandoned lifeboat a month after the disaster has been put up for auction. The eyewitness account describes how three male corpses were discovered in the collapsible boat 200 miles from the wreck site by the passing British liner RMS Oceanic on the 13th of May 1912. The bodies are believed to be of two firemen from the engine room and first-class passenger Thompson Beattie, 37, who was still dressed in his dinner jacket. According to the eyewitness account, the badly decomposed corpses were wrapped in canvases and buried at sea after prayers were said. Along with the account, the author of which is unknown, are three black and white photographs showing the recovery process. Official records relating to the Titanic disaster showed the lifeboat was never launched from the Titanic liner after it struck an iceberg and started sinking on the night of the 14th of April 1912. It was washed over the side when the Titanic sunk. The first-hand account is being sold in Devizes on Saturday, the Telegraph reports.
Here in the UK, one of the country's great summer traditions has begun with the advent of the cricket season. It's a sport that for many people sums up the essence of Britishness, and a sport that Britain exported around the globe. One of the countries that took up the game in earnest was South Africa, which continues to be one of the sport's powerhouses. Historian Dean Allen has written a book which looks at how cricket took root in South Africa during the 19th century, at a time when it was inextricably linked with thorny questions of empire. He spoke to our production editor, Spencer Mizzen.
So the book's called Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa. Could you just first of all just tell me what your motivation behind writing that was?
It's hard to put it all in a nutshell, really. I mean, it's Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa. And it was the product of a PhD that I completed in 2008. But it was too good of a story, really, just to be left to sort of academic circles. So we decided to turn it into this book, and it really has captured the imagination of everybody, certainly down in South Africa and hopefully here in the UK. It's the story of rags-to-riches story of a working-class Scot that arrived in South Africa on the back of diamonds, really, in 1877. And by the age of 25, he'd built his own town. He'd been responsible for promoting cricket in South Africa and a lot more. It's a fantastic story that, as I said, it was like finding historical gold when I discovered this man, because he really did have his fingers in so many pies at that time.
Sure. And can I take you back to a bit before James Logan arrived in South Africa? I mean, how did cricket arrive in South Africa, and was it a long time before he turned up?
Well, this is part of my wider research. I've looked at sports that were taken by the British Empire around the world. I mean, there's no coincidence that cricket is played in places like India, the West Indies, obviously Australasia, and in South Africa. And I wanted to look at the pattern of how that happened. And my vested interest is in South Africa. I did my PhD, most of my PhD, at a place called Stellenbosch, a very renowned university down there. And I'm fascinated with how certain sports took root down there. So cricket, yeah, actually did arrive with the English when they first colonised Southern Africa, the Cape especially. The first records of a cricket game being played was in 1802. So that was a long before, you know, my man arrived. But certainly in terms of the wider politics, cricket arrived in the late Victorian period. The so-called golden age of cricket was in the last two decades of the 19th century. And you needed people like James Logan and entrepreneurs, really, and benefactors, as they were called, to promote the game throughout the world. And that's what he did in South Africa. So there was a rich history of sport being played prior to this, but the significance of this man and this book, I trace the early international exchanges, you know, when the English cricket team arrived, which on a wider scale had, you know, greater significance than just cricket itself.
And I mean, before Logan arrived, I mean, was cricket a game played by purely colonists, or would the indigenous population have played with Afrikaners, have played the game?
No, it was a game like all modern sport, really. We as historians, we tend to look at sports from a specific viewpoint, but work has been done certainly recently post-apartheid, now that the archives have opened up, that shows that sports like football, rugby, cricket, these games of empire that were taken by the British around the world, were played by all population groups down there. I mean, there's some wonderful work by people like Andre Oldendal, who's written the foreword to the book. He's written a book called The African Game, and he details how much sort of black Africans were playing the game around this time. So it was certainly exclusive at the higher levels, but all population groups were playing it in South Africa, as they were throughout later days. I mean, it's far too simplistic to say cricket was the game of the English and rugby was the game of the Afrikaner. I mean, I've done a lot of work in that area, and I think it needs books like mine to unpick the complexities of what was happening, because of course sport was just a mirror for society. I mean, a lot of people had vested interests in politics and commercialism, and obviously the economic benefits of promoting sport, very much like today. The challenge, of course, was finding an individual like Logan and then running his life story through this book.
Did the British regard the export of cricket as a tool of empire, as a way of projecting their power over the colony?
I've got to be very careful here because I think myself and fellow historians, we've written a lot about this, but it happened certainly with certain purpose. In South Africa, there was no coincidence that cricket was taken at a time when there was political upheaval and there were problems. For example, during the Jameson raid in 1895, Rhodes's folly to try and upseat Kruger in the north. I mean, cricket tour arrived, and latterly in 1899 on the verge of the South African war. So there's certainly relationships here with cricket and sport being taken purposely, but this was later in this Victorian period. I think we now look at it and we can see the links. Now, whether sport was taken with that specific purpose at the time, it is hard to read into that. Of course, you've got to remember that the modern sport was only created in our public schools in the 1860s. I think once the British and certainly the politicians realized the power of this sporting revolution, then they took or they implemented these tours around the world to kind of cement the empire. I mean, we can see it in India and we certainly saw it in places like the West Indies, but we've also got to remember that sport remained exclusive at that time, not only in terms of privilege or wealth, but certainly in terms of race.
Okay, now if we turn to Logan himself, am I right in saying he was a Scotsman?
Yes, he was. He's a working class Scot. He was born in to meagre means in a little village called Reston, just north of Berwick-upon-Tweed, so just over the English Scottish border. As I said, he was born in 1857, and he grew up. Just an unremarkable life, really. He left school at 14 and worked on the local railways where his father also worked. But part of his identity certainly was a Scotsman, but he was very much a man of empire later.
So how did he end up in South Africa?
Well, this is where the story takes a remarkable twist. He, at the age of 19, I think he was ambitious. His ambitions outgrew the confines of, the class confines of late Victorian Britain. Remember, he was working class. He worked on the local railways. And at that time, you were encouraged, if there was anything about you, to get on a ship and go and make your fortune elsewhere. And ironically, he was actually on his way to Australia. He wasn't even heading to South Africa. But something had just happened down in South Africa that was going to change the whole context of that part of the world. Diamonds, of course, had been discovered in the Kimberley region. So by the time that James Logan, his ship, which had left London in February 1877, by the time it docked in Simonstown, just off of Cape Town, he no doubt had a few conversations and people advised him he might want to try his luck in Cape Town, or certainly in the Cape Colony, where this incredible wealth had been discovered. He then gets signed off from the ship's master, makes his way to Cape Town Station, which had just been completed. And within a matter of months, he's gone from porter of the station to station master. Clearly he had some kind of charisma and an experience and business savvy. And he never did make it to Australia, of course, because South Africa, as we know, or the Cape Colony, as it was at that time, was going to make his fortune.
And so you say he ended up a millionaire by the age of 25, is that right?
Well, he certainly acquired enough wealth to build his own town, and that's the other part of my title, of course. It's Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa, Logan of Mikiesfontein.
Yeah, so can you tell us about this place then?
Yeah, Mikiesfontein is this incredible place in the South African Karoo, this semi-desert region that I would say the majority of South Africans have heard of, either visited. It's part of their folklore, it's part of South African heritage. So when I first visited it myself in the late 90s, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It's a perfectly preserved Victorian village in the middle of nowhere. Mikiesfontein, if you can imagine, and now it literally looks like one street, but you have the original facets of the British Empire. You have imported street lamps from London. You have this ornate ironwork from the foundries of Scotland, Canadian pine. You have this incredible centerpiece, which features on the book, which is the Hotel Milner, which is this wonderful late Victorian building, almost like a mock castle that is the centerpiece, because Logan turned this village into a resort for the rich and wealthy at that time. But how I explain it in my book, why he ended up there, I think he wanted to have a smokescreen for his other activities. Now, if he built a village in a place where no one had created anything, of course, where water hadn't even been discovered at that time. And remember, the lifeblood was the railway that was going through the interior up to Kimberley. So for Logan, he saw the opportunity. He bought land cheaply. He joined together three farms and that created this amazing place, which today still holds such fascination for South Africans. And I believe, you know, for the Brits that go down on holiday, if they do stumble upon this place, they want to find out more.
You say it was a cover for his other activities. What do you mean by other activities? What else is he up to?
Well, can we be frank? I don't think he would have made his money through working on the railways so quickly. I found evidence of his dealings with people like Cecil Rhodes and Sir James Sivright. I mean, influential politicians at the time, and the RAN lords, of course. And, you know, rather unscrupulous activity was taking place there. I mean, diamonds had been discovered. A lot of them weren't declared, insider trading, these kind of things. And that's why people have not written this man's story, because he didn't keep detailed records.
So how did he get involved with cricket? I mean, did he play it himself to any level?
Well, it's a lovely story of James Logan. He invites the English cricket teams and the cream of first-class cricket to play at Mikey's Fontaine, of course. Why he got involved with it, I often explain at my talks, is the fact that cricket at that time was the game. It was the game of empire. Forget rugby, forget football. Cricket made the front and the back pages. I mean, W.G. Grace was at the height of his fame. I mean, supposedly, you know, one of the most famous Victorians. And Logan recognized this. He recognized the power of the game. And remember, he was new money. He came from a working class background. So to buy influence and to be regarded as a good gentleman or a good sportsman, what better way than to promote this empire game? What better way than to bring the English cricket team down to South Africa? And that's what he set out to do with his wealth. So that's his motive behind it. You ask whether he was a player. Yes, he was quite a keen cricketer. Wonderful stories within the book of how the English cricket teams would visit and play at Mikey's Fontaine. By the way, he invested in 1894 thousands of pounds into a first-class pitch so this could happen. Remember, all the teams would travel through the country by rail, and Mikey's Fontaine was a stop on the railway. And that's the key to this story, because railways, as Rhodes famously said, was the key to the continent. James Logan was a railwayman, now acquired all this wealth. So the cricket teams would arrive. James Logan would often put on a wonderful party, and a game as well that centred around a game of cricket. And they said that you should never get the host out unless he made double figures. So even against the best English bowlers, James Logan would always get double figures, it would seem.
And so how did the tour go? I mean, was it a success?
Well, no, there was numerous tours, of course. The first England cricket team came down in 1888-89 into South Africa, which is relatively late. We've got to remember that cricket was being taken around the world in places like North America, Australia, far earlier than it actually arrived in South Africa. So 1888 was relatively late. Major Wharton arrived with the first English cricket team, and that created a big amount of news down there, not only there, but throughout the English-speaking world. In 1891, James Logan decided to get involved in the second tour. And that's this wonderful story that I write about in the book, which often it gets picked up in my interviews, where James Logan sponsored the tour of Walter Reed with the aim of getting his money back with interest. So he wanted to make money out of this. Like, it was a commercial enterprise. Forget the days of amateurism. Both the English cricket authorities, certainly the captain and the management, wanted to make money out of this tour, as did James Logan. But because this second tour in 1891 did not make the money they had expected, James Logan had the English cricket team arrested as they boarded their ship back to England. Incredible stuff.
That's purely because the tour didn't make as much money as he was anticipating.
Exactly, and they had an agreement. I've seen the letters between the two that he'd want his money back, and the English team thought they were going to slip away, and James Logan had other ideas. So he served the writ. The ship sailed late, and there's a wonderful write-up in the book, the Cape Argus, the local newspaper, who thought this was a wonderful thing, a colonial taking on the establishment, writes how, and James Logan sues the English cricket team for £857 damages, which was quite a considerable amount in those days. And the Cape Argus writes it up as Gentleman of England Zero, South Africa, J.D. Logan, 857, not out, innings declared closed. I mean, that's wonderful stuff.
So how would this have gone down back in England?
Well, there was this, peep, there was I discuss it in the book. There's a debate, of course, between what are these tours for? Do we declare openly that these men are making money out of the tour? Remember, there's a distinction at this time between the gentlemen and the players. The players were the professionals, generally working class, the hardworking bowlers who declared their earnings on tour. Whereas the gentlemen, often the captain and the star batsman, the aristocracy, they would, of course, be paid, but in different ways. And they would not declare their earnings. They would play for the love of the game. So you had this wonderful kind of smokescreen that was going on. James Logan declared himself, I'm not as the sportsman, as someone who is a benefactor of the game, who would not make money out of it. So he was writing in the press this. And of course, the English defended themselves as well. I mean, you can't get a better shamateur, as some of my colleagues has called this, than W.G. Grace, of course. I mean, he was a GP, a doctor working in the West Country, and he gave up his practice because he was earning so much from cricket at that time, but he never declared that. And James Logan, of course, realized this, as did the English. And you have this wonderful kind of backwards and forwards in the press at that time of how they are all denigrating this wonderful name of sport, the amateur ethos. And then, of course, what James Logan's main objective, of course, was to take his own South African team back to the old country. That was really where he was going to make his name. And for that to happen, he engaged with a chap called Lord Hawke, this aristocratic Yorkshireman who was very powerful in the corridors of Lords, the MCC. And in 1895, Logan brought his own team down. Hawke brought his first English cricket team down in this, where this relationship was cemented.
Did a touring team make it from South Africa to England under Logan's auspices?
Well, very much so. In 1894, the first ever South African team left the shores to go back to the old country. And Logan, by now, was that influential. He was going to control this team. He wanted to control the management of it. But he fell out with his friend Cecil Rhodes over the selection of a player called Crom Hendricks. Now, Crom Hendricks was a Cape Malay player who the English had said was one of the finest bowlers they'd ever faced in the practice nets. And note that I said the practice nets. He never played first class cricket because of the colour of his skin. Now, Logan wanted to select Hendricks. He wanted this team to be competitive. He didn't want to go back to England and, you know, be beaten. So Cecil Rhodes stepped in and actually took control of the tour because he didn't want a non-white player to be picked for the South African team. So this theme of race and sport goes long before apartheid, of course. And I think that's why it's important that these wider themes are explored in a book such as mine. Eventually, of course, Cecil Rhodes would explain the reasons behind what he did in 1894 to a future English captain called Pelham Warner. And he actually said, while speaking to Warner at Oxford University, ironically enough, given the current debate over Cecil Rhodes's legacy, that his hands were tied in 1894. He could not have a player of colour selected for South Africa because the English would have him throwing boomerangs during the lunch interval, which is powerful stuff. And what he's referring to is the first Australian team that toured England were actually an Aboriginal team. And instead of cricket, the English public had them throwing boomerangs and putting on some kind of circus. Now that shows the importance of these tours. Rhodes recognised the political impact that this tour had to be representative of a colonial South Africa. And so that is part of this story, which often raises some eyebrows. But as you can probably detect, this is more than cricket, what we're talking about here. It's the wider empire.
But the tour did still go ahead then, nonetheless.
In 1894, the tour went ahead. They were quite competitive. Logan, of course, got his way. And this is an amazing story. Logan got his way in 1901. In 1899, he was on the verge of taking a team he controlled back to the UK. But in October 1899, as we're all aware, the South African War broke out. You know, gold had been discovered. Kruger and the Republics were sitting on one of the greatest mineral deposits the world had known. James Logan threw his lot, obviously, into the empire. I mean, he opened up Mikey's Fontaine for the British Army. So in November 1899, it wasn't the rich and famous staying at Mikey's Fontaine. It was the British Army base there, people like Ironside and Haig and later Kitchener. But to go back to the cricket, in 1901, he agreed with his mate Lord Hawke, remember, back in the corridors of Lords, that they would arrange a first-class tour to take place. So in April 1901, while the war was still raging, Logan puts together a decent side, including his son, by the way. The only time he ever played first-class cricket was for South Africa because his dad controlled the side. And he leaves Cape Town and they play 15 first-class matches throughout the United Kingdom while the war is taking place. Incredible. I couldn't believe that nobody had ever written about this. And Arthur Conan Doyle, no less, writes in the press as they arrive, "How dare a team of cricketers arrive on our shores when they should be fighting a war back in their own country? And James Logan, being the wonderful media man and appreciating the written word, by the way, he owned his own newspaper in South Africa, so a lot of the news that came out was positive, turned the thing round and pointed out his own efforts in the war. They even wore the colour of the South African war medal on their jerseys. Within weeks, they became darlings of the British press and they went on to compete. But it was about building James Logan's reputation, of course, and the 1901 tour, which is the second ever South African tour to the UK, cemented that.
Was that kind of the high water mark of his career, you think? Yes,
I think so. I mean, the thing with Logan, he knew when to get into things. He also knew when to get out of things. I mean, we haven't talked about his political activity, which is incredible.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was a bit of a canny political operator, wasn't he?
He was referred to as a political chameleon. I mean, he crossed the floor. There was no real strong party affiliation at that time in the colony. So he would basically be the party of James Logan, which in itself sounds mercenary, but he also was a man of his times. He was actually referred to as a man of his times by a lot of the press. The ideal colonial was another wonderful tag that he had, as well as the Laird of Mikeysfontein, the Lord, which came from himself, of course. He was a very good self-publicist. But in terms of politics, he was aligned to Rhodes and the so-called progressives and the empire builders. But the war brought all that to an end. Rhodes, of course, was no longer. And Logan withdrew from politics permanently in 1908. And then, of course, the 1910 Union Act and changed the whole political landscape of South Africa forever. But you cannot discount the kind of legacy and the impact that people like Logan, as unscrupulous and as entrepreneurial as they were and self-interested, had during this period.
What impact on, I mean, his career and on cricket more generally in South Africa did the Boer War have? I imagine it was quite a catastrophic impact, wasn't it?
It was fundamental. I mean, the South African War, the Anglo-Boer War, as it's sometimes known, really does still affect South Africa's psyche today. And remember, it's a civil war. It wasn't a white man's war. It wasn't between the English and the Afrikaners. It affected everybody. It split households. You know, the concentration camps, the scorched earth policy of Kitchener. I mean, it really, really has wounds that perhaps are not even healed to this day. For this particular story, it did change everything. I mean, the late Victorian period, the 1890s, was Logan's golden age. People like Rudyard Kipling, Randolph Churchill, the Sultan of Zanzibar. I mean, they all visited Mikeysfontein. A lot of my research comes from not just South African documentation and press. It comes from the wider British Empire. This man and his town were on everybody's lips. Now, the war brought that to an end, of course. But he was canny enough to use the war for also publicity. I mean, as I said, he put his efforts behind the British. He offered his town as a remount camp. I mean, by November 1899, there were 10,000 Imperial troops, 20,000 horses stationed there as they made their way up to the front at Kimberley along the railway lines. Remember, a lot of the early battles were fought along the railway lines anyway. So it had a fundamental effect, not just on this story, but on the wider politics and society in South Africa. Some historians said it was inevitable. I suppose the forces of imperialism and the doggedness of Kruger and his republics to the north. It was a real clash of cultures. And of course, gold was behind all of it.
Is the generalisation that the war drove Afrikaners away from cricket into the arms of rugby, is that a generalisation or is there truth behind that?
Well, I I certainly think there is some truth behind that. I've done a lot of work in that area. In fact, before I turned my focus to cricket, my previous work has actually dealt with Afrikaner nationalism and rugby. I mean, we're all aware of the Springbok symbol and what it means to Afrikaans people in South Africa. I mean, they built up this almost brand of the thing. You know, I talk to my students often about 95 and that symbolic image of Mandela handing a trophy to a white Afrikaans captain, Francois Pienaar, and what it means. But to understand that, you have to go right back to this period that I'm a specialist in. I would say that prior to the South African War, English Afrikaans, Indians, Black Africans were all playing cricket. We're all playing all the sports. But what the sport did, it defined certain identities, which is natural. So after the war, we find that more English speaking schools will concentrate on cricket and perhaps football, and the Afrikaners took rugby and made it their own game. And that didn't happen overnight. There's some work by my master's supervisor, Floris van der Merwe, down in South Africa, that suggests that the Afrikaners, a lot of them, the rural ones, only learnt the game in the prisoner of war camps. So it was the English were responsible for spreading their sporting ethos and the codes, and then they took it back to their communities. And with the rise of Afrikaner nationalism leading up, of course, up to 1948 and the National Party getting into power, you had this glorification of this suffering during the war. The Afrikaans language was promoted, the Calvinist religion, and on the back of this revolution came rugby. Remember, this was, if you were going to beat the English at their own game, how do you do it? Do you take them on at cricket or Crown Green Bowls, or do you take them on that very manly, masculine game, rugby? And that's what they did, and they embraced it.
Right, finally, just returning to Logan, what do you see as being his principal legacy in South Africa, and more especially South African cricket?
Well, to South Africans, there's an incredible place that sits in the semi-desert region called Mikiesfontein, which is part of their folklore. It really is. I mean, it amazes me when I give my talks throughout the country, how many people know about this place and the impact it has on their heritage. So from that point of view, yes, but from a wider historical point of view, I think James Logan was one of those entrepreneurs, one of those ideal colonials that was down there in the right place at the right time. And of course, acquired great wealth and acquired it through unscrupulous means, perhaps. But he certainly did leave a legacy. And that, of course, brings us to our wider debate of the legacy of the likes of Rhodes and those kind of people. I mean, I do not certainly glorify these as individuals. These were unscrupulous, hard businessmen who would do anything for a buck. But they also did influence perhaps the way we live today in terms of our sporting structures and those kind of things.
That was Dean Allen. His book, Empire, War and Cricket in South Africa, is out now, published by Zebra Press. Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but do listen in next time when we'll be talking about the history of consumerism and Chinese philosophy. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com. And we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.